Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I'm Ken Levine, your podcast host, and I am on vacation this week. So this is a best of episode, and we go way back 4 years, actually, to an interview that I did with Earl Pomerantz. And Earl Pomerantz, a terrific writer, worked on both the Gary Shandling shows for many years. He wrote on great MTM shows like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda and Phyllis, etc. Also wrote on Taxi and on Cheers, created Major Dad. And unfortunately, a couple of years ago, Earl passed away. And I want to remember him, and I want you to remember him. He was a lovely guy with tremendous insights. So I thought, if I'm going to do a best of episode, why don't I do one that really is meaningful to me? And hopefully you'll get an awful lot out of it. So here again is my interview from 2018 with the late Earl Pomerantz. Well, the current vogue in comedy is to be edgy. You know, if you don't offend somebody, then you haven't done it right. And yet, you have had a very long and illustrious career, and none of your comedy, thinking back all through the years, none of your comedy has ever been mean-spirited.
It's what I do. I'm not particularly... I have moments of mean-spiritedness, but not in scripts and... You know, why bring darkness to people? You know, it's a comedy is an invitation to forget about your life and enjoy the silliness of what's being provided to you. I don't mind having a point of view or an attitude.
Right.
But I almost never, if I do something and it's like a mean person, like in my blog, I'll go in brackets, name a mean person of your choice here. It's like I'm the opposite of name jokes. Uh-huh. Because I don't, you know, pick a guy and the guy's like reading my blog and go, hey, why is he slamming me? I'm just reading a blog or I'm just watching a TV show. Suddenly my name gets, my children are, Dad, are you awful?
Yeah.
No, I thought, this writer thought I was awful. I'm okay. So, there are people who for whom that's their style. And, you know, my agent, 25 years ago, said, start getting edgy. He was telling me, you know, the door is
he coming. He saw it coming, huh?
He saw it coming, and I couldn't do... My basic premise is, you are what you are, you do what you do. And if you do that the best you know how, that's the best you can do. But I've seen writers try to contort themselves into a style that's more popular than the one that perhaps got them
right
through the door.
Right.
They can't do it. Nobody can do them better than them. So you may as well focus on doing the best you can do. And that's what I've always done.
And there's also an awful lot of humanity in whatever you write. I mean, you really do
tend to
write about characters.
I do. And when I won the Humanitas Prize, so you're
yeah.
right. So they wouldn't lie. Those are priests voting. And
you're Jewish.
They gave it to me. Well, how couldn't they not? They gave it to me. I mean, there's a lot of Jewish writers. They gave it to me anyway. But I remember receiving that prize and thinking, why are they giving people a prize for writing like human beings? That's what we're supposed to do.
Huh.
So it felt like you were getting a prize for doing the normal thing that writers normally do, which is explore human behavior and interaction, relationships, and find something worthwhile about it. So that just seemed like a normal thing. So when that happened, I was just like, you know, I'll take the money, but I don't understand what this why they're doing it. So,
what's your writing process?
In doing what?
In writing a script.
It's been a while, but
it's like riding a bike. You remember?
I do writing every day, 5 days a week, and I meditate in the morning so my brain will calm down, and then I go in and I do it.
So when you write a script, you're fairly disciplined.
We've done the thing. When working on shows, you have a meeting with the producers, and you lay out the story, and then you go home and write an outline where you add whatever your contribution is, and then they tell you, "Didn't you listen at the meeting? We don't want what you got. We want what we told you. Didn't you write it down?" I said, "Well, yeah, okay, I'll do that." So then you stick to whatever it is that they're focusing on, and you write a script, and then you fix the script. But yeah, I'm disciplined I don't get distracted, and I don't get blocked very much ever, I don't think. You just...
You don't wait till the last minute.
When I started out, I used to get 2 weeks to write, and I had 1 week to be scared and then 1 week to do it. So the first week I'd go, Mary Tyler Moore and those shows, I go like, those guys are good, and now me? So I just tried to do the best I knew how, but at the beginning I would be really like, I may not be able to do this. And then I do it. So,
but then the next one, you'd have the same fear.
Almost always. Until later. And a lot of times, when we wrote shows like Late Line and stuff, there was no time for anxiety.
Right.
We were always behind. And we'd sit down in three or fours and we'd work out the script together. And we'd be just, the personal element was no longer a factor. You were just professionally doing your job. At the beginning, I would be terrified. There's always Canada and snow if I wasn't successful. So that was the thing that kept me. I don't want that. So, that's where I come from. People may not know I go to Toronto.
You were working at MTM
yeah.
back when it was known as Camelot for writers. And this was the 70s. And you had what I thought was the world's greatest job because, it's great to be on staff of a show. But the downside of that is you're working a million hours.
Right.
And you had a position there where you just got to write scripts
right.
for all the various shows.
I didn't get to. I kind of in a flurry of insanity demanded to.
Okay.
I wrote a Spec Mary, which they made, and they put me as a story editor on Phyllis, which was a new show. And those shows only had like two people on staff.
Yeah, back in those days,
right.
Yeah.
And and Ed Weinberger and Stan Daniels were producing three shows at the same time. So you barely saw them. And I'd write a script, and then Cloris Leachman would show up 2 hours late and, say bad things about the script. And I'd go like, this isn't a good job. I want to be here, but I don't want to do this.
Uh-huh.
And so I went into Weinberger and I said, I want to do this thing where I write 8 scripts a year. And Mary Tyler Moore at that time had Newhart, they had Mary, they had Rhoda, they had Phyllis, they had Doc, they had a whole bunch of shows.
Tony Randall
later.
Yeah.
So you could rotate around. And I literally would knock on doors and say, you want me to help you? They say, yeah, come on in. It would be Hugh Wilson or Gary Goldberg or whoever was producing that show or Patchett and Tarsus. And I'd go and work for them. And then I'd write a script, go home at 4 o'clock. I had an office. One had a shower in it even. It was like actually a dressing room. But it was the biggest office I ever had till later. And it was the best job for me because I was single. Therefore, my financial requirements were zero. And I loved driving onto the lot before the security thing, where you
right,
could just
yeah.
go
mm-hmm.
and wave. And they'd mm-hmm. say, yeah, you don't look like a killer. And they just let you on. And I'd go home at 4 o'clock and people would be staying till 2 in the morning. And I'd go, that doesn't seem like fun to me. So I had enough money and I had a creativity and a range. So because I didn't have to work on just one show, I could jump all over the place. And I had lots of fun. And people were happy to see me. Because they were tired and I wasn't. So they
I think they'd resent you.
No, well, they might, but I was like the sixth man, you know. I would be like show up and bring some rejuvenation to the process. So that was my best job. Then, unfortunately, I got ambitious, and that was not a good idea. But let me say one thing. Before my time, in the 50s and 60s, when people wrote comedies, it was possible with 39 episodes and a small production staff for freelance writers to make a really good living just being freelance writers.
That's true.
They didn't have to move up the ladder. They didn't have to do the things that they were never good at in the first place. Writer doesn't mean you're a good producer. Producer doesn't mean you're a good showrunner. And none of that stuff is connected except in the minds of agents and people who just want to move up because they've done something already and want to see what else there is, which ultimately I did. But I never had as much fun as I did in the 3 years at MTM doing 8 scripts a year.
Now, you came to a crossroads in 1975. Mm-hmm. Lorne Michaels offered you a job on the original Saturday Night Live.
Correct.
And you decided not to take it. How come?
First of all, Lorne Michaels was my brother's partner in Canada. They were writers and producers and comedians. And they did specials in Canada, and I wrote for them. Then they split up. Lorne came to L.A., and I'd written something for one of his shows that he showed to Lily Tomlin. And she said, I want him on my special. So that was my first job down here.
And you won an Emmy for that, didn't you?
The first one, the Muppets won an Emmy. And the second one, we were beaten by a piece of felt.
Uh-huh.
But the second one, we won an Emmy. We were nominated both times. Anyway, Lorne brought me down to do that revised version of that little film. And then I did only shows that he produced. Whatever he did, I did a Flip Wilson special, I did a Hollywood Palladium special, all these variety shows that I wasn't particularly great at, except for Lily Tomlin, where I was good. And then he said, we're going to New York, and I said, I'm not going. I've been here 9 months. I love the sun. I love Los Angeles. I said, I don't want to go. I don't even know where that came into my head to say I don't want to go, because the only guy who'd ever hired me was now leaving town, which left me totally starting over in my career, except I had some reputation because of Lily Tomlin. And I made up an idea for an episode of Mary Tyler Moore just when I was falling asleep one night, just to salvage myself, because Saturday Night Live had a six-month pre-programming setup thing.
Right.
They didn't know what they were, so they needed 6 months to figure out what to be. Lorne would constantly call me saying, when are you coming to New York? And I'd say, I'm not coming. And I didn't have a job. So I sat there, and somehow my brain bailed me out. I showed this two-page outline to two writers, two women who'd worked on Rhoda, but also on Lily Tomlin. So I knew them, Banta and Nardo. They were real names, not just
Gloria Banta and
Elaine Nardo.
Yeah.
And they said, this is a good thing. You should submit it to Mary Tyler Moore, a two-page outline. I had no idea that you had to write a spec script. I didn't know anything about half hours. So I got my agent, who was this woman who ended up being this famous crazy woman who represented Jay Leno in the wars, the late night wars.
Right.
Helen Gorman, but she was Helen Kushnick.
Uh-huh.
And she got it to Ed Weinberger, who was the producer of Mary. And that outline was developed with Ed and Stan and me into an actual produced episode. That was very rare. That even a spec script is rarely produced into a...
I mean, it's incredibly rare.
I mean, winning
the lottery, rare.
So can I tell one other...
Sure.
Side of the story.
Sure.
They helped me develop this into an episode. It was during hiatus. They were producing two pilots, so they were in town. Jim Brooks, who created Mary Tyler Moore, was out of town on vacation. When Jim came back, they said, oh, we got this great new writer. He said, yeah, what's he doing? Well, he came in with this idea. Mary thinks a priest is leaving the priesthood because he's in love with her. And we sent him away to write the first draft. Jim Brooks said, I hate that idea. Call him up right now and tell him to stop. And they said, well, you know, we have to pay him for the draft anyway. But let's see how it turns out. And it turned out okay. And therefore, I got a career in half-hour comedy. I just wanted to tell that to show how close you can come to being the guy who just drove me over here, who wants to be stuff but isn't.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's that close. You said winning the lottery. It was not only winning the lottery because they took the idea and helped me develop it, but that Jim Brooks was out of town and didn't say no before I got to start writing it.
That's true.
That's stories. That's what people who want to be in show business need to hear about, is that it's been close for all of us. None of, I mean, you can, if you want, tell your own version of, I almost didn't get anywhere.
Oh, exactly. But when given the opportunity, you delivered. You turned in a good draft. If your draft wasn't any good,
yes,
then you'd be the guy
and that's
driving
the,
somebody today.
Well, I can't drive, but I do something. That's the answer to success is all about who you know. Who you know will get you in the door, but it won't keep you in the door.
Right.
So who you know is fine. It's excellent. I knew Lorne Michaels, but I'd worked for him. He didn't know me because I was his cousin. He knew me because I'd written this thing on his show that Lily Tomlin liked, and he thought it was good enough to show to her as a writing sample for me. So he was more or less my agent starting out. And well, because I never worked on Saturday Night Live, he's never really been friendly. You know, I've spoken to him once in 44 years.
Wow. I was going to ask you about that, what your relationship
betrayed.
Was like.
Uh-huh. I think he felt, you know, he felt like he'd done this stuff for me. And yes, that was true. But I couldn't go there. I didn't. And in retrospect, I'm glad I didn't go there because that show was another kind of show. I could have creatively probably done it, but for a while. But the time, the writing a show in one day and all that urgency, I don't think I would have liked that process at all.
Yeah.
And I don't think I would have been that helpful to him. But he really wanted me to be part of that, and I let him down.
Okay. Well, you finally got a chance to do some of your own shows. And, you know, people talk about write what you know and doing series that are loosely autobiographical. You sold a show that was so much you and your life that you even had your living room
correct.
Recreated on the soundstage. Talk a little bit about that.
That's called Family Man. I worked on Cosby. And I'd been the first executive producer. I was there for the first 7 episodes, and then I burnt out and went home. And Brandon Tartikoff at the time, who was NBC president, said, do your version of Cosby. Do your family. I said, okay. He told me that when I was doing warm-up man on Cheers. I was on the second year of Cheers, I was a warm-up man. So he saw me during the show, and he said, come over here. I want to tell you. Do that. So I did it. I did Family Man, and it was based on a writer and a wife and a biological child and a stepchild and all the stuff that's part of me. And I did build that set, and the front of my house it wasn't like a My Three Sons on the Universal lot. It was the facade of the front of the Family Man house, because I thought if you're going to be original, it's the same as I said before about the best me is me. If I'm going to have an original set, not built by some set designer, why not do the one that nobody else has, which is the one in my house? So they took pictures. They actually went and took Polaroids off the back of my house because I have an ocean view off the back.
Oh,
and they built
backdrop.
This huge backdrop. The big one. You know, the one that goes right across.
Uh-huh.
So that was the backdrop of my actual house. So I thought, and more importantly, I guess, every story, I only got to do 11 episodes. Every story was a story that happened to me, either as a kid or as a parent. So I wanted that kind of uniqueness. Nobody could compete with me as me. So those were the stories I told.
Was
I guess
this
if
a
the show was a big hit.
Was this a multi-camera show?
That's where I started to make mistakes. It was a multi-camera show, but it was on tape. So I said, I want more sets, therefore no studio audience.
Uh-huh.
So it was almost a soap opera comedy. I mean, the actors didn't know it was funny until we screened it in front of an audience, and the audience actually laughed. And they went, oh, it was good. But they didn't know because there wasn't the best feedback in the world, which is the live audience. I didn't want 3 sets. I wanted 7 sets. So basically, in my heart, I wanted to do a single-camera show, but they weren't doing them back then.
Right.
So, and they were more expensive back then because it was before digital. They used actual film. I guess MASH was really expensive in its day.
Yeah. Well, although we made those episodes really quickly.
Uh-huh.
Like 3 days.
So that
now they take 5 days.
That was
we
the way to compensate for how expensive. Because
we were guerrilla filmmaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the time, I think you were one of the only one-camera shows on television.
I think we were the only.
So how did, show. It was because Fox did the movie MASH that they did it?
Yeah.
Because you couldn't sell that without
no,
the movie.
No, exactly.
Every show was either on film or on tape. And tape was cheaper than film. And one-camera film was more expensive than multi-camera film. So I wanted to do the, I wanted to tell the stories that needed the sets that were needed. I didn't want the sets to tell me how to tell the stories. I wanted the story to tell me how to tell the story.
Who played you?
Richard Libertini.
Okay.
Who was very funny and very good.
Okay.
And, I got really in trouble with the set decorator because he was set decorating this girl's, 11-year-old girl's, bedroom.
Uh-huh.
I brought her in to check it out and see if it had legitimacy. And he was pissed. I'm a professional. Were you going to bring your baby in now and look at the baby's room? Because I had a 2-year-old daughter. He didn't like it. But I said, what's wrong with that? It's right to do it as truly as you possibly can. And if you have an 11-year-old to pass an evaluation, I say go for it.
Now, did your wife sign off on all of this?
She didn't want any part of it.
I was going to say, because, you know, my wife always claims that when I refer to her in travelogues or the blog or whatever, that she's just a character. She's just this created character in my life.
Well, they're both in the therapy business, and they also need the confidentiality. So even on my blog, I try to keep her out of it as much as possible at her request.
Right.
But yeah, she is a character. But the line, her original line got into the pilot of Family Man, which is someone asked, what's it like living with a comedy writer? She'd go, we laugh all the time. that was her payback.
So did you guys ever have an argument and in the middle she stopped and said, I don't want to see this on TV.
I don't remember because the show didn't last that long. So if that,
it was on NBC?
NBC ultimately passed on it, although they took the title. It was called Our House, and they put it on another NBC show.
Oh.
So I thanked them for that. It ended up being on ABC, but like after the season, like April or something like that. And there were like 7 episodes. I wrote 11 scripts. I imagine if I'd had a successful show, I would have had to expand the concept beyond what happened to me as a child and as a grown-up. But I didn't think about that because I originally wanted to tell fresh stories, and that's the only way I knew how. Otherwise, it's your crazy neighbor moves in because they're fumigating his house. Uh-huh. You know, you can look at almost every series, and ultimately they do the same stories. You know, in-laws are coming, where's their present that we threw out?
Right.
You know, I had this kind of embarrassing word, purity. I wanted it to be pure. I wanted it to be original and fresh.
Do the 7 episodes still exist somewhere?
In my garage somewhere, but they could be dusty.
Uh-huh.
They're on cassette, you know. Those things don't endure very long.
Right. You should digitize them.
You know, my past doesn't mean anything to me. I did it, and I bought a house. You know, I did it the best I knew how. But I don't have any nostalgia. You miss, my favorite show that I made up was Best of the West, which lasted 1 season.
Right, which was a great show.
It was a
Western,
yeah,
multi-camera show.
Exactly. We had a bear on stage,
uh-huh,
a giant bear. It was lovely. It was so much fun. We had a wonderful cast. And people liked it, and then the network put it on against Magnum or some other show that was being... Oh, Dallas.
Uh-huh.
First Magnum,
wow.
Then Dallas. Uh-huh. And I went... I'm in a supermarket, and all the magazines have pictures of stars of the show that are on against my show,
uh-huh,
on the cover,
uh-huh,
by the checkout stand.
Right.
And none of mine. Uh-huh. So I went, I better not buy too much. You know, this isn't going to last. But that was the only series that I made it as funny as I knew how, but also used a lot of research, a lot of trueness that I could find about the West to find comedy that, you know... F Troop didn't do. It wasn't goofy. It was another thing. It was basically Mary Tyler Moore in the West, you know, some kind of similar sensibility. So that's what I did.
You know, it seems very difficult for a period piece to work as a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's happened from time to time. You mentioned F Troop way back in the 60s.
And right.
Certainly MASH,
right,
period piece. But for the most part, It's really a hard sell.
Yeah,
70s
yeah.
show, I guess, did okay, too.
Yeah, because that was the premise.
Yeah.
But, no, it was a hard sell. And I think networks, ultimately, if they don't like a show, will find a way to get it canceled.
Oh, you know, easily. Yeah, they can easily kill a show.
It's another thing I tell writers when I meet them sometimes, is you'll pitch an idea for a series or something like that, and they'll say, well, you know, we're not crazy about X, but go ahead, give it a try. And you write the outline in the first draft and the second draft, and you're really excited, and you're making it come alive, and you bring it in, and they said, yeah, we're going to pass. Why? X.
Uh-huh.
The thing they hated at the beginning is the thing they hate at the end. So why they waste your time, you know, developing something they never wanted to do in the first place? I don't know if they still do that, but you always talk about your blog.
They do it more.
You talk about how much more networks have control.
Yeah.
When I did Major Dad, which was lasted 4 years, was the most successful show I ever did. The guy who was the head of CBS at the time, on the night before the pilot, said I'd be cast the leading lady. And here's the guy who's going to decide whether that show is going on the air, telling me that I haven't got a chance. Fortunately, we had one of the greatest pilot filming nights of all time, and he had to accept the leading lady and the show. But that's what happened even back then when they didn't have total control. So he could say things like, if I were you, I would, which is code for don't be a schmuck. You know, I'm putting this on the schedule or I'm not. So there was always a network element of, I wouldn't know what to do now. It seems agents must have a horrible time now because it's never over pitching a show. There's 5,000 places to pitch. So you have to, you know, it's not three places and go and, you know, take a nap.
Right. Except now it's, well, that's a Netflix show. Uh-uh. That might be a Hulu show. I don't think it's Amazon Prime. It might be Fox.
Right. And I knew a guy who mistakenly pitched the wrong way to the wrong place. He was told that, what you just said.
Uh-huh.
And then he just forgot where he was, and he got it turned down because he forgot how to pitch it. Uh-huh. So it was all about they developed different pitches for the
sure,
same show. Based on what the you know, the interests and tastes are. I don't know. I'm old and I'm out of it. But I still wish I could drive through the gate. You know, just fun. There was this one time I went after September 11th. I went to Fox for a meeting, and I drove up, and this guard woman gave me this big smile. And I went, oh, I don't know. I drove up. I gave her my ID, and the smile went away. And I thought, oh, I'm in trouble. I must look like a terrorist. And she said, I said, what's the matter? Is there a problem? She said, no, I thought you were that comedian, Adam Chandling. I was like this generic Jew person who wasn't the person she expected. So I was Adam Chandling the last time I went through a gate.
You worked with Gary Chandling on both of his shows.
I did.
Talk a little bit about working with Gary.
I'll do it through a story. I went, even though I had worked on the first show with Gary Shandling, so he wanted to interview me for Larry Sanders. I don't know why. I was the same person. And I went up to Studio City. He was editing an episode of Larry Sanders. He called me and, come on in to the editing room. And he started asking me, editing, what should I do? Should I do a long shot? And I said, I don't want to do this. If you want to interview me for the job, let's do it separately. And I went home.
Uh-huh.
And then he called me back up. Sorry, and I was like, we have breakfast, so we're gonna have breakfast on Montana Avenue in a place. And he's about 10 or 15 minutes late, not terrible. And he comes in and he says, "Sorry, I'm late. I just broke up with my girlfriend." I said, "Oh, that's terrible. When did that happen?" He said, 9 months ago." And so that's Gary Shandling. He told, I don't know if that was a joke or not a joke.
Uh-huh.
And that's what made his show so special, is that the difference between comedy and tragedy was, you know, tiny. And so you didn't know, you could never tell whether he was putting you on or whether he was doing a joke or whether. And that was the element of Larry Sanders that made it so original, is that the comedy and the tragedy were totally interwoven, and you couldn't tell, barely tell the difference, which made it feel truer than joke-driven shows.
Was it hard to write?
I didn't write scripts because they did foul language and I can't do it. Once he made me read one of the scripts when one of the actors wasn't there and I had to read this stuff, and I was like red as a beet reading. I was a good reader, but the dialogue was... So I always came in 1 or 2 days a week to make the stories focus and maybe pitch jokes for character situation, which is what I ultimately did after... My series work was over, is I would help people make their shows, in my view, better by working really hard. Even didn't matter what the show was. I'd read the script over and over till I could find something that I could contribute that I thought would make it sharper and more what they were intending.
Now, you would read the script before?
Yes.
Because usually...
Not Larry Sanders. They didn't have a script.
Yeah, they didn't have script. But normally, when they would bring in a consultant, he would come to an afternoon run-through at like 4 o'clock, mm-hmm. and then he would go back into the room with the writers, and he would help them punch up. He would sort of be a script doctor.
Right.
And I did that for many years on many shows. Like you, I love that job.
Right.
But the difference between you and me is I would also get the script usually the morning of the run-through. I never read it.
Huh.
I absolutely made a point never to read it, because I wanted to see that run through with virgin eyes.
Right.
You know?
This was table reading. It wasn't run through. So it was before that. I would even, my last thing was According to Jim. I did it for 2 years, mostly because my agent was a showrunner's agent and he made them hire me. and I would literally read the script on the weekend before the Monday reading 3 times. Looking for holes, looking for things that I could punch up from a story perspective. Once in a while, there'd be jokes that would be jokes related to telling the story, to shoring up the story, or shortening, short-circuiting, cutting page 11 or page 8.
Uh-huh.
And I would say, you never need page 8.
Yeah, you know, this is a thing I have to mention, that Earl is known for page 8, and he always maintains, and we have always found this to be incredibly true, that if you have a script that's really long and you have to go back and you cut it, Earl contends that you can always just lift page 8. And so the first thing we would do was go to page 8, you know, to try to prove him wrong, and most of the time we'd go, God, you know, we really don't need the first half of this. You know,
I'd have fun reading any script, trying to find a way to make it the best version of what they're trying to do as it could be. I wouldn't try to turn it into what I would do, because that's irrelevant.
Right.
And I could do that. I could do that today if I could do that today, if I could do one day of doing that. But I couldn't do it on one camera shows because I don't understand them. I mean, a show like Modern Family does 3 stories an episode. That means you tell a story in 7 minutes. That's a Fleer's Double Bubble cartoon. I don't know how to.
We used to do that on MASH. We used to do 2 to 3 stories.
I find
stories.
It amazing.
Yeah,
because that's not how we did the multi-camera shows. They were more like a play.
It was easier on MASH when we brought in freelance writers to just give them the outline and walk them through it, as opposed to explaining to them just what it is that we're trying to accomplish here. You know, it's like we knew how to plot these things. We would do that work, just hand them the outline and walk
and
them through, because it is very difficult and tricky and unique.
And keep it tight.
I mean,
that's really the tightest version of a show.
Yeah.
Here's something you mentioned sometimes, because you always talk about multi-camera shows coming back, maybe, or and then certainly there are more of them than there were at their least popular time. But I haven't seen a good one. I've seen them, but I haven't seen one that was like to the level of when multi-camera shows were really good.
I would agree with you. And I know that sounds like, you know, hey, kids, get off my lawn.
Right.
But
the guy who drove me here said the same thing.
Yeah. I look back
I got to give a tip. I forgot to do the
shows that we wrote. And, you know, I think shows like Frasier and Cheers, Mary Tyler Moore Show, things like that, stand the test of time 40 years later.
Do you think it's, you know, there was a time when people were really good at physical comedy and silent movies and stuff.
Right.
And then there was a time when they didn't do that so much anymore. Do you think there were just people who were good at it and then the generational shift happened and then they're good at something else, but they're not good at what they used to be?
Personally, I think it's that our standards were higher. Our standards were higher.
I look at
something like Big Bang Theory, which is very funny, but they'll do a show where in the first scene, Sheldon has a problem,
mm-hmm.
and he tells Leonard. And then in the next scene, he goes to Penny and tells her the problem. And then the next scene, he's at work and he tells the guys at work the problem.
Right.
And then the next scene, he goes to the comic book store and he tells those guys the problem. And there's different jokes along the way,
right,
but it does nothing to further the story.
Right.
And I think we were a lot tougher on the story and having endings be surprising and have a little more depth. I mean, of the multi-camera shows that are out there, I think the best is Mom. I think they try to do that as well as they can.
But they fall into parody of themselves,
yeah,
like most shows do ultimately. I watched Big Bang Theory and Modern Family at the beginning, and after a relatively short time compared to the regular audience, I went, I get this. I know what they're doing. I don't want to watch it anymore. And Mom was the same thing. I thought Mom was sensational at the beginning. But after a while, you do joke H, where you did joke A in the pilot. You
right.
know, it's just the I don't know what H is. Eight. It's eight. It's the eighth carbon copy of the original really good joke.
Right.
I don't know how you get away from that other than bringing in new characters. Mary Tyler Moore did that all the time. They brought in Betty White, or they brought, you know, people left, people came in. They kept it fresh. Cheers, obviously, they brought in a new female lead. People who are professionals like ourselves, you get tired of the formula. You see it sooner than other people, and then you just you can't stay with it anymore.
Right.
So
you
let's
now
not
blog.
End on that. Let's end on something a yeah. little cheerful.
Let's talk about your blog.
Okay.
You've been doing a blog now for
47 years. When I started, my first paying job, of which I received $25 a week, was a weekly column in the Toronto Telegram, which was a major newspaper in Toronto. I could write anything I wanted for 700 or 800 words. 40 years later, I'm doing exactly the same thing. I could, in certain ways, take certain columns that I wrote in 1968 and 69, and they would fit not that terribly into my blog today. My perspective is not that different. My style, my comedic approach is not that different. I'm a little more skillful now, but so it's basically full circle. I've been doing the blog ever since the strike. What was it? Well, like 2007?
Which one?
I know. But the one that happened, the last one that happened.
Yeah, I think 2007,
people were all in line with a stick walking around the studio with me, mm-hmm. talking about all the things they were doing and planning. And I wasn't doing anything. And then I knew you did a blog. And I went, well, why don't I do that? You know, I wouldn't have to deal with actors. I wouldn't have to go anywhere. I wouldn't have to drive on the highway. And I talked to you, and we had lunch, and you came over to my house, and you set it up for me. And the coolest thing, I'm flattering myself at the moment, you said, what do you want to call it? And I had no idea you're supposed to call a blog anything. I didn't know anything about blog. And I immediately said, Just Thinking. And that's what it's about. It's about anything that comes to my mind, from summer camp to writing in show business to I just came back from a week studying at Oxford University. I'm writing about that. I wrote about heart surgery when I had heart. I just write about whatever happens in my life, hopefully in a way beyond I had a sandwich and the mayo was too thick.
Okay.
You know,
Family Man finally gets on the air,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah, with my own voice.
Uh-huh.
And maybe podcasts in the future. I don't know. I don't know how to
see how this works out.
Well,
for
technologically,
you
I haven't got a clue. I can barely turn on a fan.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I don't know how to do that. But, yeah, I just write what I think about with no network interference. That's the best part.
Well, it's a great blog. I've been
Thanks.
Plugging it for years.
Oh, good.
In fact, there are times when you and I will go back and forth
mm-hmm.
in our blogs discussing
because we don't always
topic.
Agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have done that.
Yeah.
Well, we
where
couldn't
do they
work
find
up
it?
A feud.
Yeah. That's right.
Where
do they find it?
On the computer. It's what
No, what's the link?
What does it mean? A link? What do you tell me? It's Just Thinking. If you write Just Thinking in your thing, will it go there or no?
No. Tell you what. Tell you what. Go to Google, type in Earl Pomerantz blog. It will take you to it, and you can just click onto it, and then
department.
You know, put it in your bookmarks. Or if you can go to my blog, I have links along the side, one of which is Earl Pomerantz. Just click on that, and it will take you to his
blog. I think it says Earl Pomerantz at blogspot.com. I think that's what it is.
Okay,
if that's
like
wrong,
that.
And you know what? You found out that it went offline. I didn't even know it. I was in England. I don't know how that happened at all, but it's back. So
the Russians?
Yeah, they hate me.
Probably. Earl, this was great. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you. That was fun.
Okay, that was my interview with the late Earl Pomerantz. Oh, I miss him so, so much. Anyway, thanks as always to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. If you want to get in touch with me, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com is my email address. That is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Also, I am on Twitter @KenLevine, Instagram HollywoodAndLevine, and I would appreciate if you follow me on one of those social media hot spots. Anyway, new stuff again next week. Thanks so much for listening. See you soon. Hollywood and Levine.